FM. Listen in color.
Well, I'm here with legendary composer, arranger, saxophone player, musical director, and by the way, pillar of the British musical scene. He's an Emmy winner. He's a BAFTA winner. I usually basically call him a winner. I feel like a winner when I hang out with him. And incidentally, he's one of the great encyclopedias of music knowledge. John Altman is here. I met John, well, we met about 8 years ago.
Possibly more.
Maybe nine now. Time is flying by. Back in LA at the 2020 Club.
Yep.
I remember I was walking up onto the stage to sit in with Ryan Cross and his band, the Lorca Heart Ryan Cross Jazz Experience. And as I walked up onto the stage, you said to me, "I've worked with your father, I've worked with your mother, I've worked with your grandmother." And I said, "Well, I guess you're going to work with me now." And we have. We've worked together. We've done all kinds of things. You've conducted orchestras when I've sung. I've played with your big band. We've done stuff with a quartet together. And it's been a great pleasure, my friend. And
indeed,
we've had quite a friendship. Anyway, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, for you, what separates jazz from every other kind of music?
Oh, that's a big question. There's a number of things. I mean, I could get all technical and start defining, you know, the rhythmic thing, or the you know, the harmonic structures, or the development from you know, the alliance of Western and African music, or there's all kinds of ways one can throw the melting pot. But to me, it's something about a spirit of how music is approached and how music is performed and how it's thought about that seems to be something that stems from, you know, the jazz experience, that from the early days right the way through as a continuous thing. So the sort of spark that lit up Louis Armstrong is the same spark that lit up Miles Davis, is the same spark that lit up John Coltrane, is the same spark that lit up Esperanza Spalding, or whoever you want to name, or Herbie Hancock. And I think it's a spirit thing rather than a textbook definition.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What for you, you know, has changed about jazz in sort of the last, say, 30 years? Like, you know, what's so different now? Is there something you see? Or is it more just, you know, I mean, you naming people across a time period there as if it's a fairly unbroken chain. But do you see something that's changed in sort of the jazz world from the musical point of view in the last, you know, 25, 30 years?
It's interesting because I think if you're actually in the middle of, I don't know whether you want to call it a movement or a musical genre or a style or music making or something, I don't think you really are conscious of changes until you look back and you listen to something and
right.
You say, oh, you know, good heavens, that is 1967 or that's 1990 or whatever it might be. Obviously, the introduction of synthesizers and things like that changed the sound of music as we know it. And I'm not just talking about jazz, I'm talking across the board,
right.
You know. And then the influence of world music on music making, the fact that people were listening to African musicians and
right.
African musicians were listening to jazz musicians, and there was that sort of cross-pollination that took
sure.
place in the music world. So bands like, for example, Weather Report were the sort of pioneers at that sort of bringing together of different cultural styles.
Sure.
But in a way, it's like the question of saying, well, when I work with people who are, you know, were playing music in the 1960s, and we listen to one of their records, and they say, well, I don't play like that anymore, and my equipment doesn't sound like that anymore. And it's like looking at a photograph of yourself in 1970 or 1980, the way you're dressed and the way you... It's a different person. And I think music changes in that same way as well.
I think you're right. That's a very interesting way of looking at it. When you were a kid, getting your first exposure to jazz music, which is a lot of your life. You've put a lot of focus into jazz. It's mm-hmm. one of your great loves, yeah. although you're not really restricted to jazz, but certainly known for it. Who were your heroes? Who were the people that helped to light that pilot light for you?
Well, it was very interesting because like you, we're very similar because we were born into the music business, as it were. And because my mother's brothers are all well-known jazz musicians and band leaders, when I was 3 years old and beginning to be aware that there was something called music in the world, I could hear Twinkle Twinkle Little Star played on a sort of toy Glockenspiel, or I could hear the Count Basie band playing Texas Shuffle on my gramophone, and that was far more interesting and exciting.
Right, right.
So I got bitten by the bug straight away.
Right, I remember my dad's was, you know, famously his favorite two toys when he was 4 years old were his Lionel HO scale train set and his Emerson Cathedral radio.
Yeah.
You know, so you had that kind of exposure. It was around you. And I should interject by saying that your uncle, Sid Phillips, mm-hmm. was my grandmother, Dame Thora Heard, her favorite musician of any.
That's right.
Literally her favorite band
she told me.
Ever, which is, you know, totally incidental to the fact that we've become friends, but it's a very, very cool thing. So,
but it was interesting because my uncle conducting for Sinatra and Nat Cole and Judy Garland and the Andrews Sisters and Danny Kaye meant that not only was I hearing records, but I could actually associate the people I was listening to with the people I knew, which is quite an odd experience, which, again, you must have shared.
Yes, you know, because, I totally know what you're talking about.
Because if you heard a drum solo by Buddy Rich and he suddenly appeared in your living room, you know,
right.
it's very so odd when
it's
you're...
It's funny because the two textures, the texture of the personality and the human
yeah.
being, very real skin, bones, hair, you know, breathing, is sort of mixed in.
Intertwined.
Completely.
And we're very lucky to have come to music through that double exposure.
Sure.
Because normally, if you think about it, you know, if you're a kid growing up, it was different then because...
You mean as opposed to like coming from outside of it completely
yeah.
and it almost having that exclusion anxiety to begin with and then having to get...
Well, the interesting thing, because, I mean, when I was a kid, you mentioned radios. Radio in Britain in the 1950s was... there wasn't that much music available. You know, you had one television channel when I was small.
right, what was that, BBC One?
BBC
One,
yeah,
okay.
Basically BBC. ITV came along in the mid-50s,
okay.
So you had two.
And there were only four when I was growing up.
Yeah, radio, radio was a light program, which had basically dance music.
Right.
The home service, which was talk. The third program, which was classical music.
Wow. Okay.
And, you know, most of radio-like program output was comedy or drama or soap operas or whatever. So if you wanted to hear music, Radio Luxembourg, which was available, which was the sort of more pop side of it, was the commercial radio with the terrible reception that you just about
right,
pick up.
Right.
But we were lucky because we'd inherited a pile of 78s. And
sure, that's.
I don't remember my parents listening to them. That's the odd thing. I remember discovering them myself, and instead of sort of picking them up and throwing them against the wall.
This is unbelievable. I had the same experience, only in the form of my father's Wurlitzer jukebox
yeah.
that sat in our pool room, the room with the pool table. Okay, so that explains what I was doing in there a lot, playing pool growing up, okay?
Yeah.
And I discovered so much, including those early Artie Shaw records, the Meltones records, all of these amazing, amazing records from really the, you know, the golden age, really, of jazz from, you know, the late 30s through, you know, the very early 50s. On my own, you know, just hanging
Ooh.
Out because they were there and they were just playing. I'd turn it on. It would cycle through. You know what I mean? So it's a very similar thing there.
Yeah.
Where we just had the thing. We had the hand-me-downs almost, but it wasn't put in front of us. We sort of organically discovered exactly. it because it was part of our environment.
And then you see, I'd go to school and the kids would be singing, you know, Elvis Presley and Bill Haley and, you know, Tommy Steele singing the blues.
Yeah, well.
So you sort of, you had that, but you also had your own music, which were you were amazed that nobody else had a clue about what you were playing. I remember when I was 7 years old, I was told to bring in your favourite record. And people were bringing in, you know, Little White Bull and Sparky's Magic Piano and all these things. And I took in Count Basie's Texas Shuffle with Lester Young's tenor solo. And yeah. you can imagine a bunch of seven-year-olds sort of
it's so
with their jaws dropping going, what on earth are we listening to?
I mean, again, you know, this is about you today. But, I mean, the parallels are amazing because, you know, I was, you know, a 13 and 14-year-old. Everyone's listening to Eurythmics and Status Quo and NXS and things like that. And my favorite music at that time were, like, some of the very early records that my dad had made on Musicraft
yes.
and Coral and even some of those early Capitol records, you know, with Pete Rugolo, you know, and, you know, the Pete Rugolo Orchestra. Those cloudy early records.
Yeah, I mean, wonderful.
How could you be more displaced, though, from your peers?
Exactly.
It's not a great way to get popularity at that particular age, I noticed. But, you know, I'm still proud that I stuck to my real
The great trick is, and the great thing about you, and I know from my own point of view, was that I came to maturity at a time when music exploded. You know, when the Beatles exploded, when the R&B invasion took place, when folk music became something, you know, that wasn't done by old people with beards in, you know, and holes in their sweaters. And I luckily was able to immerse myself in all those genres as well. Yeah. So when I started playing sax, I was playing blues in a blues band. I was playing rock and roll in a rock and roll band. I then was in psychedelic bands. I would play my flute in folk clubs. I basically exposed my creativity to every single style of music, including jazz.
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. You know, here we are, we're coming into this age, and to be a little more saxophone specific for a second here, you know, we're coming to this time with, you know, the Brandon Allens, you know, the Alex Garnetts, the Danny Janklows, who, granted, is a Dick Oates protege. So there's an older influence, and I'm sure all these guys have mentors, you know, including yourself, who have, you know, breathed, you know, that influence in and kind of made them aware that they don't, you know, ignore some of the older influences and only have like newer influences. But, you know, the Soweto Kinches, the Graham Blevenses, is there a difference a little bit though? You know, you sit and you listen to those cats. Is there a difference in their approach other than, you know, what we talked about a little earlier in terms of the different environment and different influences?
Of course. The harmonic vocabulary has opened up as well. You know. However, the sort of fan chain, or whatever you want to call it, is still the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want to play jazz saxophone, sooner or later you are going to listen to Ben Webster, Don Byas, Coleman Hawkins, Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane. You absolutely have to. Even if you come in and say, I like Michael Brecker's playing, so I'm going to take up the saxophone, you have to become aware that Michael Brecker didn't suddenly spring from nowhere playing the way he did.
Of course.
That he came from something else. And I was very lucky because of the era I was born in and the interest I had, that I got to see Ben Webster and Coleman Hawkins and Don Byas.
Wow, you saw all those guys.
Well, I took Ben Webster to buy washing powder in Water Street.
Amazing.
My mother was a friend of Coleman Hawkins, so we went backstage at Ronnie to meet up with her.
This is what I'm telling you about, folks, the John Altman tree of influence. It's like everyone is pretty much either
connected.
Zero or one steps away. Everybody from John Altman.
Well, Ben Webster used to hang out in the basement at Dobell's Jazz Record Shop, which is a sadly missed haunt of my youth.
Wow.
And wow. I would go straight from school. I was at school in the city, and it was two stops to Leicester Square, and I'd go into the John Kendall ran the basement. He would find, you know, obscure records and hand them to
that me. That he knew you would like.
Yeah.
Right. Because he learned your taste over
Well,
time,
in those days, that's what people did in record stores.
Right. You know, Almost like DJs do now. Still.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? You still see a DJ, like an EDM DJ,
yep.
will go in and kind of like the guy knows, you know, what to what to play him. There's a few white labels and things yep. like that. So it was kind of like that.
It was only, totally like
only
that.
That was jazz because back then, still, in a way, jazz was pop, right?
Yeah. But that's how you got exposed to anything. You know, I mean, you go into a record shop and you'd be looking through, like, you know, let's say the blues rack. And the guy working behind the counter would say, oh, you know, are you like blues? You know, have you heard Bobby Bland? Or, you know, do you know this album? And you'd suddenly hear music that you'd never heard before. You know, oh, I think you'll like this one. Yeah. So you sort of relied on them to be right. your disc jockey, as it
sure.
were, because there wasn't a radio station that said to you, now listen to this,
right.
now listen to that.
That.
You didn't have that.
We do have that now.
We have it now.
Maybe too much.
Too much,
okay.
yeah. But, so John Kendall would say, here's something you'll like, here's something you know, you
wow.
should listen to. And you got to know a lot of people.
And that was like feeding the well,
and
basically.
Ben Webster would come in and sit on the chair, and John would play him Stride piano records, and he would guess who the pianist was, you know. And it was fantastic. He would be telling stories,
yeah.
you know. And I would stand in the corner in my school uniform and going through, you know, eavesdropping. And then one day he said, I need to wash my shirts. Where can I buy washing powder, you know? And John Kendall said, oh, I've got no idea, you know, I don't know. And I happened to know that there was a Chinese supermarket in, I think it was Tower Street. It was somewhere around Shaftesbury Avenue.
Okay.
Walking distance.
Right.
So I said, oh, you know, there's a Chinese store up the road that sells all kinds of things. And he looked around at me and said, take me there. So we went off.
That's so crazy.
And he held up a box of Tide and Surf.
Oh,
you
sure,
know,
sure.
And he showed them to me. He said, which one do you suggest? And I was 14 years old. I never washed a shirt in my life. You know? So, but I sort of remember the commercial
oh,
on the TV for Tide. And I said, oh, you know, take the Tide. And
yes.
next week I went to see him at Klook's Cleek, which was a London jazz venue.
Yeah.
And he came up to me and he sort of slapped me on the back and said, great choice. And my mates who were there were like, you know Ben Webster? Oh, yeah, we you know, I gave him some saxophone tips.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, speaking of jazz being pop, which clearly it was, you know,
mm-hmm.
my dad was first doing his thing. It was like being, you know, John Legend or somebody like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was. I saw a documentary at a film festival a couple days ago, and Harry Connick was featuring heavily on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying two things again and again. He was saying that, you know, first of all, that sort of jazz is bar none the greatest artistic contribution that's ever been made to the world by America.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was saying a slightly less exciting statement, which was he was saying that sort of America has turned its back on jazz.
Mm.
Is there any truth in that? I mean, I remember when you and I just recently, when we were performing together at the Michael Parkinson's National Jazz Archive event, I remember Sir Michael saying that a few times. He was saying sort of the same thing. You know, he was saying that mainstream support for jazz music is just incredibly hard to come by at this point, and what a travesty that is. How accurate is that?
Well, there's a lot of truth and a lot of misplaced pessimism as well. And the big problem is, and it's something I've actually revised my thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
My thought always used to be that, and we've got to talk about audiences, young audiences, which is basically the consumer
of live music,
right. and music, want to hear people their own age perform. They don't want to see their grandparents and their, you know,
they
even
don't.
Their parents
they don't.
Performing.
No. Right.
Now, that,
I
that,
gotcha.
Now, that was my thought for years and
yeah.
years and years.
Yeah.
And then along came the Rolling Stones tour.
Right.
And if you think about it, it's kids going to see guys in their 70s playing music.
In other words, they find they're open to the mystique. Actually, that's a draw for them at this point.
Yeah, unfortunately,
it's different, right?
It's different. Unfortunately, the golden age of jazz, if you want to call it that, when it was pop music, is just that far away now, which is a blessing and a curse.
Sure.
It's that far removed that nobody has a memory of it. But also, because it's that far removed, it means it's got a clean slate and therefore should appeal to people on its own strength because it doesn't have baggage.
Right.
It's like if you talk to somebody age 20 today about World War II, you may as well be talking about Napoleon or, you know, the Corn Law riots or something like that.
Right.
It has no relevance whatsoever. You know, it's not their grandparents' generation. Their grandparents were listening to the Beatles. It's not their parents' generation. They were listening to the Eurythmics and the, you know, Duran Duran.
Right.
Therefore, the music has to stand on its own merit. Now, we're into another thing then.
Sure.
We're into how is the music put over? Is it put over as an intellectual exercise that people have to switch off their dancing feet and go and listen to?
Well, that's what my father always
this
said.
This is the big problem.
The problem was
when
bebop came out and you had Miles Davis facing the corner, not even facing the audience, and doing the, you know, the shadowy thing, which of course is so cool, but at the same time,
but the thing
it wasn't
is,
danceable.
The thing is, when it you can't have your cake and eat it.
Right.
When it becomes an art form and talked about as an art form, it's no longer part of a popular culture.
I see. It gets a loftiness.
That you have to go into a concert hall and be shushed and sit there. Now, you listen to Bill Evans at the Village Vanguard, you know, probably what the greatest jazz album ever.
Right.
There is continuous chatter behind the music, you know, and it sounds like there are 10 people applauding at the end.
Right.
Jazz was a nightclub music, you know, it was smoky nightclubs. Or it was big band dance music, where people got up and leapt about. You mentioned Artie Shaw. Artie Shaw was maybe 23, 24 when he led his band. Benny Goodman was 26.
Wow.
Harry James was 19.
You forget how young these
punks.
Cats were.
They were punks. The energy, look at Hollywood Hotel. I'm sure you've seen that film a million times. The Benny Goodman band, they're punk musicians.
You're right.
They're a higher standard of musicianship than the punk bands, but the energy is that energy.
It was a rebellious actual
thing. It's a rebellion,
thing, right?
And people are dancing in the aisles, and they're having a good time. You know, I mean, it's really important not to lose that focus on what jazz was. And the trouble is, when you put it into the concert hall and you go to the Barbican or the Royal Festival Hall, and you sit in the audience, and you sit quietly and you only applaud at the end of, you know, of the numbers, you're dignifying it, which is what, you know, jazz was after becoming dignified and serious way back to Rhapsody in Blue and things like that. But you're also removing it from pop music culture, because if you go to a pop festival and you see, you know, Chic or Jay-Z or Justin Timberlake, you're dancing. You're up with the crowd and you're grooving around
totally.
And leaping about.
Totally.
So you can't, you have to come down one side or the other. You know, you can't have jazz as a serious concert music and then complain that young audiences aren't making it their choice of leisure, you know.
You think there's a space for both kinds of energy, though? Within...
Well, I think so. I mean, I went to see Enrico Pianunzi, a great Italian jazz pianist, at the Vortex last weekend. It was packed out with a young audience. I mean, it was a listening audience, but it was, you know, totally immersed in the music.
Right.
And I was easily I was the oldest person there, but the ironic fact is that Enrico Pianunzi and I were born on the same day of the same year, the same month. So
just your little connection with him.
With him. We were jointly the oldest people in the house, you know. So it's interesting because...
Well, you've performed with all kinds of different people.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, you have such a broad, you know, such a breadth, I guess is the word, of different artists that you've either... you know, been sort of in charge of their operation, or you've arranged or
yeah, I've been very,
for them. I mean, it's such a range.
It's mind-boggling.
It's Joss Stone. It's, you know, Eric Idle. You know what I mean? Like, how can you even, it's, you know, well, Van Morrison, who you were the MD for yep. many years.
Well, I say to people, I'm the only person to have conducted the Royal Philharmonic and played saxophone with Little Richard. I can't see, at all points in between, I can't see anybody else
it's
claiming
It's unbelievable.
That.
So, okay, looking back, from a musical satisfaction point of view, give me a couple of the artists, a couple of the highlights for you, you know, where you came out of a project and were like, that was just dope. That was just everything. That's why I became a musician.
Well,
I mean, is it true about all the projects? It can't be true about every project.
No, but it's true that you bring something to each project, whether it's arranging for an artist or playing your sax with someone or whatever. I mean, I've been so lucky because I've experienced some of the best musicians on the planet. And again, you're talking about the range, you know, to have played with Muddy Waters, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Marley, Amy Winehouse, Prince. You know, I mean, you can't get better than that.
No.
You can't do it.
That's pretty much it.
And then
you've
to go to then to go to point. Nick Drake and the Soft Machine and
James Torme.
James Torme,
for example.
Exactly. Mel Torme.
Sure. So you played with my dad.
I arranged something.
You arranged
for him.
Something, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
that was your working with my dad.
That right was there. Working with your dad, yeah. but
cool.
to have arranged for Barry White, Tina Turner, Dinah Ross, George Michael, Rod Stewart, Bjork.
To name a few.
To name a few.
Wow.
It's wonderful. You know, I mean,
it's
yeah,
just
a highlight. It's,
almost the range itself is what it brings a satisfaction
well,
to you.
I guess the,
having
the,
so many different experiences is adds up to a rich man.
It does. Well, the case in point, I would say, would be Muddy Waters, because it was so pivotal, because A, because the first band I played in did Muddy Waters songs.
Ugh.
B, because he then
That's convenient.
B, because he then played at my 21st birthday party.
Wow.
And my first band was there. So we backed him.
No way.
Doing the set that
no
we'd done.
No way.
C, because he insisted that I play with him, with his band. D, because I played a superb solo. And at the end of it, and on one particular number, I thought, oh, I'll just show off a bit, you know, and show him what I can do. And as soon as I did that, I went, no, that was wrong. You know,
right,
that
right.
didn't work.
But that
and
taught,
that taught
you something.
Me a lesson.
That taught you something right there.
So it basically did everything. It was
it's
like
an education.
An education, uplifting, dream come true, miracle.
Stimulating. From a creative point of view.
And you know, something
and
that,
a great memory.
Something that can't
have.
Be repeated.
Yeah.
You
makes
know, how could you repeat that?
That's crazy.
Have Muddy Waters come and play at your birthday.
You can't, Uncle
you
John.
Can't.
You
no.
can't.
It's a once in a lifetime.
Now, you recently took a soul funk band out to China.
Yes.
That trip didn't quite go the way you were expecting. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Let's say there was a sort of a permit crackdown in operation. On,
a permit crackdown?
On
venues. What exactly is a permit crackdown?
Well, they were investigating clubs that didn't have the right permit to put on concerts and things like that. And they did a sweep of various venues, including mine. And
so you guys get there
a
for
SWAT
the
team. A SWAT team came in and sort of carted a number of people away. I won't
wow.
say any more than that.
Wow. And now you ended up, so those concerts like didn't happen.
No.
And then, but you ended up doing some concerts anyway. You just happened.
No,
to,
we,
what happened in
Andy
the
Summers came out.
Oh, that's
place.
Right.
We're good friends and we were having a holiday anyway.
Okay.
And we did a couple of small intimate things that weren't public concerts.
So the tour, the show went on, it just in a slightly different,
a different
form
way,
from what you
yeah,
were expecting.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, are they hip to jazz? Like, what's the vibe
very much
in
so.
China? Because I've
very
been hearing
much
for a few years
music.
That it's a really amazing. I'm hoping to go out there sometime.
Yeah, it's a big music.
Sort of Wild West, almost like for Western
with,
artists
within
to come
reason,
in.
Yeah,
or is
I
it more about jazz and classical?
No, I think it's everything. You know, I mean, it seems to be. You know, there seems to be keenness to experience because they have no history of music. Therefore, a Kenny G concert will outsell a Rolling Stones concert because they don't know who either of them are. But they respond to Kenny G more than they respond to the Stones, you know, which is fair enough, because if you've, you know, if you've not heard a particular style of music, right, you have no...
There's no bias. There's no, there's marketing.
No backstory.
Like, there's no kind of programming that's already happened.
No.
Nobody's been brainwashed into any kind of notion.
No,
it's,
I mean,
just
good,
a, it's an
good
open
thing
slate.
For me
that's
is,
a good thing, right?
Well, the good thing for me is they love Titanic and all things associated with which I am one.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Now, John, you wrote about 80% of the music in that film.
Correct that. No.
Oh well, how much music? Well, it's basically all of the string.
It's all
of the string arrangements.
No, it's all the ship's orchestra.
Right.
So
which is going on all the way through the film.
Which is going on all the way through the film.
So that's why I'm thinking it's like most of the music.
It's not
in there.
Actually most of the music. No,
but it's a lot.
It's quite a bit.
Now,
and obviously,
and then you had a little bit of a watershed with that recently, right?
Because, yes, because the 3D film came out and did ridiculously well in China.
And now, didn't they release the album with every single copy of the film? So you,
they
had,
did.
You had to get the soundtrack too.
Yeah.
So that was a good thing for you, right?
I hope so, yeah. Finally,
cool.
After. But they didn't want to release it at the time the film came out because they thought the film was going to flop.
Right. How bizarre.
Yeah. They were convinced it was going to fail, and they said, we don't want to spend too much energy and money on,
that's so funny,
you know, on putting out an album because the film's not going to do well, so nobody will want to buy the album. Boy, were they wrong.
Boy, were they wrong on that, huh? Well,
unreal.
Tell me for a second about the State of the Union here in London for jazz. What's the happening spot right now?
Well, it's,
what are you doing?
It's
where,
always,
where do we go?
What I see is it's always changing. It's interesting because we both have a knowledge of London and Los Angeles. And I'm sure you agree with me that the... I don't like to say the scene is dying in Los Angeles, but what I do have to say is it's changing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And whether these changes are better or worse, I don't know.
Kind of...
but it's a kind of...
jury's out on that.
It's a shifting of what used to be has gone and won't come back. So it is now what's there and what's about to be there, and it's changing, and it's driven a lot more by a younger generation, let's say. When, you know, when I started playing and going to LA, it was very much a mainstream thing that was part of the fabric of LA life. It's now no longer that. You know, it's become more edgy and more clubs opening, and
right.
You sort of find that here as well. There are lots of small venues that you might not know about that are starting up, and a whole cadre. I mean, the thing that unites both places is that there's loads of young musicians coming out who want to play. Hundreds of them. You know, it's sort of where they're all coming from, I don't know. Where they're all going to go, I don't know either. You know, the desire to play jazz is as strong as ever, probably stronger.
You've been doing a club, you've been doing like a night with Patrick.
Yes.
From the Drifters, who's a friend of both of ours.
Yeah. Well, this is a continuation of a night we did. It's not strictly a jazz night. It's
right.
A sort of a funk jam session.
Right.
We started it at a club called The Ten Room in 1999.
Which was a big deal at the time, I remember.
And it became a very big deal.
And then you had Pigalle, right?
And then we went to the Pigalle, and we had, I mean, basically a who's who of popular music was performing there.
Yeah, I remember seeing the videos.
It was everyone. I mean, and all for free. You know, from
how
Stevie
amazing.
Wonder, Prince, R. Kelly,
Justin Timberlake,
Alicia
Daniel
Keys,
Bedingfield,
Daniel Bedingfield, Lionel Richie, The Roots.
So this is really
Black
this
Eyed
is
Peas.
This is kind of the continuation of that, really.
And
it's
we're continuing
evolution.
That now.
The two
yeah.
of you are still doing that. Where are you doing that?
We're doing it in Chelsea at a club called Upper West.
Very
at the
cool.
Moment.
When does that
on
Thursday? Thursday nights. Very
and
cool.
And it's a guest list invitation night and. And basically, out of the Ten Room came people like Amy Winehouse and Katie Melua, and Joss Stone used to perform there in her young days.
They'd come in and like
come in
sing
and jam.
A couple songs.
Estelle started there. Dizzy Rascal started there.
Wow.
It's funny, you know, that in a way, we were responsible for a whole scene that evolved over the last 10 years. But we were, you know, and I mean, Amy certainly, you know, her whole band was the band from the club.
It's an interesting thing to think that, you know, that kind of project came out of that as a product of that environment.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, it's a very neat thing.
No, it's wonderful. And I mean, it's what I missed from my youth, because I said how I got this experience playing with all these people. The only way I got that was by going to clubs and jamming.
Right.
I got to play with Fleetwood Mac. I got to play with Nick Drake. I got to play with Jimi Hendrix, you know, well, by being around the clubs.
If I'd never gone into a club to sit in L.A. that night, I wouldn't be sitting here with you now.
Well, so, I was doing it in 1966. And
so I'm just trying to be a John Altman. I'm basically trying to follow in your footsteps.
But I'm very lucky that you know, 40-something years after I started doing it, I can still do it. And
you sure can.
Still be on, considered to be on the cutting edge.
Absolutely. You know? And you definitely are. Now, you introduced me to a host of singers, actually.
Yeah.
That I didn't really have on my radar too much. I'd kind of like heard their names, but I wasn't too familiar with them. You know, some of the key ones that I've really, you know, that have had a big influence on me in the end and on my style and my career include people like Jerry Southern, Matt Dennis, Bobby Troup, specifically Matt Dennis, who I just fell in love with. I just think his music and his voice and everything. It's funny because you introduced me to these two cats, Bobby Troup and Matt Dennis, who both kind of sound like they're like going for a similar sound as my dad.
Yeah.
You know, so it's so great because they have these songs that aren't from the Mel Torme book,
catalog,
so to speak,
yeah,
that I've been able to really, you know, latch onto.
See, what I would love to have known, and of course it's impossible to find out now, is how much contact they all had.
I know,
each other.
And you know, because Matt Dennis lived in L.A.
I know,
and so
I
I'm thinking. I mean, he must have
they
known
must have
my dad
close.
Well. They yeah. must have been. And it's just funny you don't really have any mention in my dad's autobiography.
No,
and of course I didn't know about him when my dad was still alive, so I never asked about it.
That's right.
And when I sat down as a 10-year-old and did the history of jazz for my summer project, and my dad saw me leafing through a couple books. And said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm doing a project for school. It's the history of jazz." And he said, "Well, do you want some help with that?" And I said, "Okay." He goes, "Sit down." And then proceeded to, with no corrections, with no hesitations, dictate the entire project, including, to begin with, an index of like 8 different phases of jazz that are important.
Yeah.
He didn't mention, you know, any of those guys. It was, you know, it was the, you know, the Dizzy Gillespies and the Miles Davises and the Jerry Mulligans,
sure,
and the Bessie Smiths and, you know, the people like that. But who are your very favorite jazz singers?
My favorite jazz singers are the musicians who sing. So Chet Baker, Jack Teagarden, Louis Armstrong, of course. Then people like, you know, Jerry Southern, who you've mentioned, who's a long-term favourite of mine.
I know, I remember that.
I'm not that crazy about later Sarah Vaughan. I'm not that crazy about later Ella Fitzgerald, because I just find them... I like to hear songs sung properly.
Right.
And that's part of me that's... You know, I mean, you can embellish them, but I'm not one for, you know, like...
There's a limit. There's a limit to almost the gymnastics.
Yeah, vocal
how effective that can be.
Vocal gymnastics.
Are you saying that at some point it becomes sort of gratuitous?
Well, yes, because I think that the actual songs are, you know, I think the actual songs are important.
And having like a regard for that original, the songwriter's original, you know, melody, just getting through that one way, so to speak, accurately, before bringing in other embellishments.
Well, I love that telegram that Cole Porter supposedly sent to Sinatra, which was...
What was that?
If you don't like my songs, why do you sing them? But I also, you know, I mean, you know, Gershwin wrote such great melodies. Who are some of the people to change the notes he wrote for notes that they've put in that aren't as good? You know, if he'd have wanted certain notes placed
right
in the song,
he would have put them in. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair
he would
enough.
Have put them in. So why would these people sort of, you know, just willy-nilly say, well, do you know what? I'm now going to sing, you know, My Funny Valentine, but I'm actually not going to sing one note that's in the original tune.
Right.
You know, it doesn't
that
make
does
sense
get a little,
to me.
That does get a little crazy at that point.
Doesn't make yeah. sense to me. You know,
you kind of like
really
have to be
doesn't.
On acid to like have any kind of understanding.
Yeah, I don't get it. It's very different. Even if you're improvising, you know, I'm my conception of jazz improvisation, which I arrived at quite by accident, really, although I must have imbued a lot of it when I listened to records when I was young.
Sure.
But I was in a jam session when I was 14, 15 with Philly Joe Jones, the great Miles Davis drummer. And everybody was doing these sort of calisthenics with their horns, you know, sort of up and down every scale.
Almost like doing runs when you're
yeah.
a singer.
Yeah. And I'm listening and going, well, not only can I not play like this, but I don't want to. I don't hear music like this. And I'm always attracted to the melodic improvisers like Chet Baker, Paul Desmond. You know, even, you know, Charlie Parker is melodic. Miles Davis is, you can't get more
oh,
melodic
definitely.
Than Miles.
Definitely.
You know, Tony Frisella, you know, maybe a lot, Jerry Mulligan, a lot of names, Lester Young, you know, you could keep naming them. But
right, but there is a
Penny
definitely,
Dorham,
everyone you mentioned, I know, has a melodic,
they have a
very
melodic
solid
impetus.
Exactly,
yeah.
Their own pilot light.
So my conception of improvisation was always, you know, play a tune and take your improvisation from what that tune suggests. And also knowing the lyrics to it and knowing... Dexter Gordon used to recite the lyrics to every song. And Ben Webster was playing a sax solo once and he stopped. And someone said, why did you stop playing? He said, I forgot the words. It's... You know, it's funny, but it's true.
It's amazing.
It's true. You know, I mean, the great improvisers were conscious of great melody and respectful of it.
Well, that's just as important, right? Right.
And that's how I always approached my conception to improvisation.
You know, my dad's favorite singer was Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire.
But and Bing Crosby too was up there very high for
yeah.
my dad, even though they weren't, you know.
They weren't equipped
as great
yeah.
singers, but they had such a regard for
melody. Well, I'm in the middle of reading
the melody.
Very interesting book, which I don't know if you've seen. It's called Fred Astaire and Jazz.
No, but I'm all about it. I want to know.
I have
a new show that I just put together called Torme Sings Astaire. So it's the book where if I don't read
well,
it,
have
I haven't done my
it.
Homework.
It's I'm midway through like the third chapter. But it's very interesting because it's basically putting Fred Astaire and all his work into the context of being a jazz musician. So his dancing is a jazz musician and his singing is a jazz musician.
That's a great perspective on it.
And the interesting thing they say, which I'm paraphrasing, but I may get it wrong. What he says is that he changed the style of pop music because... writers wrote for him specifically to tailor to the way he sang.
Mm.
And then the way he sang tailored how they then subsequently wrote for him.
Sure.
So he changed the style of songwriting.
Wow.
So all songs like Nice Work If You Can Get It and things
right.
like that
right.
could not have existed without him. Because
wow.
he was the catalyst for them. It wasn't a case of people giving him songs and saying, oh, I'll try and do something with that. It was, here's a song that's tailored for exactly for what you do.
Right, leaving the space almost, like, for him.
Nice work if you can get it. It's all rhythmic, and it's also a small range, which he had, the sort of small range. So,
you know, you have the same thing going on years and years later when, you know, Rod Temperton is writing those songs
for Michael Jackson, yeah.
You know, because he knew that... He liked to sing these melodic and play with the rhythms, and so he made these stabby short note
yeah.
things for, you know, songs like Rock With You.
Yep.
And it's very funny because that same behavior is happening in cyclically. It seems like it continues.
It does. It does. And it's a very interesting theory because why would people write songs, you know, tailor-made for Fred Astaire? They say yes. You know, Irving Berlin liked to hear Astaire sing his songs. That's not the same thing as I'm writing a song for Fred Astaire.
No, right.
You know, so by writing a song for Fred Astaire, he was actually changing the way he wrote songs, because he wouldn't write that song for anybody else.
All right, so it's a derivative work from something that hasn't existed yet.
Exactly. So the whole book's thesis is you know, about him as a jazz musician.
Wow.
It's very interesting.
I mean, that's something I'm so into right now that I'm going to have to borrow that when you're done with
it. Well, it's on my iPad. So.
Okay, well, you can lend me the iPad and I won't give it back.
Yeah.
I just had a wonderful show at Talk of the Town,
mm-hmm.
and the Hippodrome, the London Hippodrome. Yes. Now, that was a venue that was sort of a legendary venue.
It was.
I think it opened in about 57 or something like that, and then it had everyone from Sammy Davis Jr. to Sinatra to Judy Garland to Stevie Wonder, you name it. They all played there.
They did.
And, of course, my father, that was the place that my dad, Mel Torme, would come and play when he was in London. Now, they just brought it back a year ago, and so, you know, what a thrill to have me touching down there now and sort of beginning, well, continuing the Torme tradition at Talk of the Town. How significant is it, you know, and what is it not a good sign that a venue like that has just been brought back? Because you look at when it probably closed in about 82, right there, you know, boy, that form of entertainment was certainly losing popularity at that time. So is that... Should we be encouraged by that?
I think we should, yeah. I mean, I think that the resurgence of sort of cabaret and venues like that, you know, is to be applauded, because it's sort of, it was an iconic spot in London, definitely. I went there several times. I saw Judy Garland there, unfortunately.
Really?
Unfortunately.
Was that one of her more difficult
poorer
nights?
Performances.
Right.
And, of course, the conductor there, Bert Rhodes, was a great friend of mine. So through my family connections and later, you know, in his own right.
Have you played there since they reopened it
I've
yet?
Been there. I haven't actually performed there.
Okay, well, that'll happen real soon.
But,
you'll come play with me next time I play there. If you haven't done it yet, you'll come play with me.
No, I went to a terrific show there with Mitch Winehouse and Joss Stone.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Really, really good. Yeah.
Very cool.
Very, very enjoyable.
Well, what a pleasure. It's so great to see you, John. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jazz FM. Listen in color.